This episode of Stage 9 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 180,000 titles for smartphone, tablet, and desktop. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help Trek FM at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And also by Enterprise in Space, an international program of the nonprofit National Space Society. Find out how you can help science and education and become a virtual crew member aboard the NSS Enterprise Orbiter by visiting enterpriseinspace.org. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to Stage 9, Trek FM show about the people who make Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we are going to be talking about the fourth film by Quentin Tarantino, Kill Bill.
Or the fourth and was initially referred to as fifth film, Kill Bill Volume 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2.
No, but it was always the fourth film by Quentin Tarantino and then the new film by Quentin Tarantino.
There was early presser stuff that referred to it as the fifth, but then they stopped.
And it
disappeared.
I don't know about that.
I'm pretty sure about that because Amazon said so while I was watching.
Amazon said so?
Yeah, Amazon said so on their little pop-up video thing that they have going on the screen.
That might be revisionist history on Amazon's part. I'm not sure.
Well, who can trust the Amazon, really?
Yeah, who can?
Yeah.
But before we get into that, just a little bit of Discovery news. There is a new writer for Season 2 of Star Trek Discovery. His name is Vaughn Wilmot.
Yes.
Maybe it's Wilmot. I'm not sure. Anyway, he's a writer who's he's done a few episodes of Sons of Anarchy and Prison Break, but his big claim to fame is that he's the creator of the sci-fi original series Dominion. Mm-hmm. Have you seen Dominion?
I have not.
Have you seen the movie Legion?
The movie Legion. No, I haven't seen that.
With like the angels who are like, it's basically like Assault on Precinct 13, but with like angels or something.
I know the movie of which you speak, but I have not seen it.
It's not very good. But one of the things which, you know, was really, really interesting to me about this is the fact that they were doing a spinoff show, not just, you know, not just like a remake or whatever, but like an actual spinoff, which was, you know, called Dominion. And I'm like, wow, that's so bizarre and random and cool. And it made me like want to go back and rewatch the movie and then watch the show just to see what it would be, you know? The description on IMDb for Dominion follows the perilous journey of a rebellious young soldier who discovers he's the unlikely savior of humanity. So,
it's a good hook.
Yeah,
yeah.
I really want to check it out. I'm going to definitely check it out. You know, I'll be sure to report back. But yeah, Vaughn Wilmot, he was the creator of that show, and now he's working on Star Trek. But here's a little interesting bit of info, which I think it was Trek Movie revealed. This is not the first time that Vaughn Wilmot has worked on Star Trek, because in addition to writing, he is also, sort of an actor. And one of the things which he's acted in was Star Trek The Next Generation, where he plays the Bajoran security ensign in Descent Part 1, uncredited, apparently. Yeah,
well,
he's just like in the background doing his thing.
All right.
So there you go. Welcome back to the franchise, Vaughn.
Keeping it in the family. I love it.
So it's cool. I don't know. Aaron Harbor's posted like a couple pictures from like their office Christmas party or something like that. And there seemed to be a lot of new faces there. So I don't know, you know, some familiar faces as well, you know, Jordan Nardino and Bo-Young Kim and Kirsten Beyer and others, you know, who we've come to know and love from the writing staff, but a few new people too. So it'll be interesting to see who's at work on Disco season two.
I think it's pretty interesting too that Harbert's made actual reference to the issues with season one, and then said that they had a fantastic creative team in place where everybody knows each other. So yeah. that's kind of cool.
A lot of returning people, I'm sure. Yeah. Unlike, you know, what seems to have happened, where halfway through, you know, there's a pretty large turnaround in terms of employees, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So maybe some more stability, maybe some more planning from the ground up will mean even better Star Trek in season two. Who knows?
Yeah, who knows?
In the meantime, let's talk about Star Trek, which is even further in the future.
Yes.
Like 24th century Star Trek. I don't even know. Who knows? Quentin Tarantino's Star yes. Trek. And continuing this series with his fourth film, Kill Bill, or as it's commonly known amongst, you know, Tarantino fans, Tarantino files, Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair.
Now, for anybody who cannot get a copy of Kill Bill, The Whole Bloody Affair, you had given me a tip for how to watch the volume one and volume two to make it like The Whole Bloody Affair. And it is, you stop at a certain point in volume one, and then you skip over her car ride in volume two.
Yeah. So basically, yeah. At the end of volume one, she is telling Sophie Fatale what to tell Bill, right? So,
yeah.
So Sophie is relaying the bride's message to Bill. And you see the bride in her full motorcycle gear talking to Sophie, who's in the trunk of a car. And, you know, she says something like, I want them to know they'll all soon be as dead as O'Ren, you know. And then it cuts to black. And then in the original volume one, it comes back up out of black. You see like an airplane flying. And then there's this sort of like postscript where yeah. you're sort of like introduced to all the characters who will become players in volume two. And the most important thing there is the very last line of the movie,
yes.
in which Bill drops this huge bombshell, which, you know, then leaves us on a huge cliffhanger. And then when it comes back in volume two, there's another sort of like intro where she's driving in a car in black and white and basically mm-hmm. talking to the camera and explaining what happened in volume one and what she's doing now. Then after that's over with, it's only like 2 minutes long. It says, you know, the title comes up, it just says volume two, and then it goes into the next chapter.
Yeah.
So the it's only played, the whole bloody affair has only played a couple of times, and there have been plans, and I think even, you know, like animated sequences and stuff produced in order to make it a much larger thing. But as it exists now, it originally premiered at the Cannes Film Festival in May of 2004, so about a month after Volume 2 was released in theaters. And what Tarantino did for the original volumes was he made separate versions for the Western markets and the Eastern markets. Mm-hmm. So if you were to go to see the movie in Japan, there was about a minute and a half added to volume one, and there were some other things which were changed. The big thing, the thing which everyone talks about, is how in the showdown at the House of Blue Leaves, which is mm-hmm. in black and white in America,
yeah.
it's now in color. And oh, there's a few little edits and stuff like that. And then in volume two, most people don't even know that it's different, but it is different. When she's driving to see Esteban Vallejo,
yes.
Michael Park's character,
His second character.
Yes, his second character.
Yeah.
And by the way, you know, we can talk about that. Esteban Vallejo was originally supposed to be played by Ricardo Montalban. Which would have been really cool, but
that would have been amazing.
Yeah. It would have been.
Oh.
It would have been perfect.
Well, Park still does a I think he nails it. I mean, he does a really good job.
The reason why they did cast him is because when they were doing the read through, Montalban was unavailable. So Parks, who was there to play, you know, the sheriff at the beginning of the movie, he sat it and he's like, oh, I can, you know, read that part. And he started doing this accent and everything. And Tarantino's like, oh, this is amazing. You know, I just want to have him do it now. So Montalban lost out, which is disappointing. But what can you do?
Yeah. Yeah. What can you do? Yeah.
So, you know, anyway, in that scene, there she's like driving to it, and in the Asian version, there are two or three extra, essentially establishing shots as she's driving her car up to Esteban's villa or whatever it is. It's extremely insignificant, and I kind of think that the only reason why he did it was just to make it different because there was some sort of issue with the rights where, like, he retained the rights to the Asian versions or something like that. But regardless of that, when it played at Cannes as The Whole Bloody Affair, and there's only one print in existence, and it's played in L.A. a few times and a couple of other places, he essentially took the Asian cuts of the movies and just cut them together. Cut off that last scene in volume one and that first scene in volume two and stuck an intermission in between. And then there you have it. Like, it even says Kill Bill volume one on screen at the start of the movie. So
that's pretty great.
So if anyone has the Japanese DVDs, never released on Blu-ray, but if anyone has the Japanese DVDs, you can literally recreate The Whole Bloody Affair at home, which I do on a regular basis. So
pretty cool.
Yeah, but even if you don't have the Asian DVDs, if you want to get the closest experience you can to The Whole Bloody Affair, just cut off that last scene from volume one and that first scene from volume two, and there you go.
You know, it's funny because you had told me this. And on the other side of the room or other side of the mic, whatever.
Other side of the stage.
Other side of the stage. There you go. You had talked about how Paul Thomas Anderson said there's a natural tendency to say, no, I'm going to do it my way. Well, I indulged that. I still watched it as volume one and volume two on two separate nights.
That's fair.
This time around. I mean, you know, I had to pay two rental fees, so I might as well stretch it out as much as I can.
And I think, not to interrupt you, but Tarantino, I think, would say and has said that he's satisfied with, you know, the separation. And if you were to watch it over two nights, he'd probably want you to do it the way you did it.
Well, I'm glad, but I can tell you that, man, that ending of volume one, I this story, and I'll share it with everybody else here. When I first saw Kill Bill volume one, we've been going through the series. Oh, Reservoir Dogs. Yes. Pulp Fiction. Yes. Even saw True Romance. Love True Romance. Oh my gosh. Jackie Brown. This is a masterpiece. I adore this. He ticked me off so bad with Kill Bill volume one that it marks the end of seeing Tarantino films in the theater for several years.
That's
like
crazy.
I stopped. And it wasn't just the ending. The ending annoyed me. And the thing is, you could almost see it as a form of praise in a very childish temper tantrum sort of way, because I was enough into the movie that when it ended like that, it angered me. And I was just like, screw you. I'm not. No, this. And it's sort of like feeling like being taken for granted, like at the end of the second Matrix movie. It ends in a very similar sort of fashion. And my wife can tell you, as we were walking out, like, she saw my face like twisted up, like, I can't believe they did that. And she was like, is that cool? I was like, no, that ending really makes me upset. And also, I don't care for, I know what he's doing, and I appreciate it more now because I'm rewatching it post Grindhouse. I get what he's doing with some of these things, but that animated history of Oren Ishii, really dislike it. I really dislike it a lot. That specific sequence feels to me that there was nobody left to sort of say to Tarantino, maybe not. You know, like he was so much at the top of his esteem and top of the mountain. I'm going to do this segment animated. Nobody was like, people might not like that, you know?
See, I like that sequence a lot because to me, what Kill Bill is sort of like a love letter to movies on the whole, but in specific, like genre movies. And to me, it sort of like embraces all of the sort of like different, you know, kind of like exploitation genres that are out there, whether it's the Kung Fu movie, whether it's the Western, whether it's the anime, you know, all of that stuff. He uses all of them. And I think that it's really cool to kind of like see. It's almost like she's fighting her way through the multiplex, which I think is a term which was used probably by him, you know, when the movie came out. And, you know, that's one of the things that I really appreciate about the movie. And so having that anime sequence in the middle there, I think just kind of makes sense, you know? It's almost like I've described it this way before, but in a lot of ways, it almost feels like sort of an update and sort of like a grungier version of Citizen Kane. And that, you know, Citizen Kane was a movie which used like every filmmaking technique out there to make this, you know, masterpiece. And he's doing that, but he's doing like all of these techniques used by these sort of like marginalized filmmakers from, you know.
Yeah, no, that I'm on board with. I'm totally on board with you on that. But I like that's definitely happening here where, you know, and I even, I guess, you know, just with the benefit of time, you know, it was different mindset in person back when I watched, like watching it this time, I love the fact that he's basically making certain things that were always viewed as, you know, that you see that in a trashy movie, and he's making them respectable. Mm-hmm. He's saying, ha ha ha, this is, you have to love this because look at how cool this is. And I'm down with that. Like I even love at the beginning, you know, this is very obviously his the beginning of the Grindhouse arc for him when he has the, you know, our feature presentation at the beginning and stuff like that. And it's, you know, I've made reference to him as a Lucas type of figure previously, but it suddenly dawned on me where I was like, wow, that is exactly what the whole 20th Century Fox thing at the front of Star Wars was that was Lucas's throwback to the movies he grew up watching. And it's the Buck Rogers thing at the beginning of THX 1138 too. And so I'm down with that. I don't know why. And I watch anime. I loved anime growing up. It was a formative influence on me. I don't know why it just doesn't work for me. Like it just really doesn't work for me. I don't know why.
You know, that feature presentation thing at the beginning, like I was, you know, I never saw that, you know, on screen because I wasn't going to see movies in the 70s. But I was in film school when this thing came out and I had a teacher and he was so excited when he saw that. He was like, I never in a million years thought I would ever see that snipe in front of a movie again. And there it was, you know, and I'm like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, okay, you know, going back a little bit, this movie came out 6 years after Jackie Brown. You know, there was like a really, really long gap in between movies. It's kind of like the lost years for Tarantino. He really, really wanted to be an actor, and he tried that, and it didn't really work out very well for him. You know, all of his performances were sort of panned by critics. He was on Broadway and everything for a brief period of time. You know, no one liked that. And everyone was just kind of like, get back to directing. You know, direct a movie, please, Tarantino. This is what we want to see you do. And it almost seemed, I mean, there's different accounts as to what exactly was going on and who knows what's true or what's not. But it almost seems like he had sort of like lost his passion and like hadn't like basically had no interest in making more movies for a while. And Lawrence Bender, his producer, was really pushing him to, you know, get back at it because he knew that, you know, the world has been waiting for a new Tarantino movie for 6 years. And I mean, it wasn't quite 6 years when he got started, but he came up with this idea for Kill Bill, which is actually something that he came up with Uma Thurman on the mm-hmm. set of Pulp Fiction. When they were making that movie, they created this character of the bride, and they sort of put it in their back pocket and, you know, thought, well, one day we'll do this. And then they start, you know, developing it. Originally it was going to be like the idea was to make it like one of those, you know, grindhouse movies from the 70s. It was going to be like under 90 minutes, you know, really small, down and dirty. And just as he started writing it, it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And then it basically got to the point where he's like, well, you know, we're going to shoot all this stuff and then cut it down and we'll get it, you know, around 3 hours and release it that way. And, you know, once he had it all shot, you know, it's just too big. And instead of, you know, chopping it up, he decided to just cut it in half. You know?
See, I had always heard a different story about cutting it in half. I heard that was pushed on him by Miramax, that they said, no, we're not going to release this big thing. We want two movies.
Yeah, I mean, it probably was their idea. You know, I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. But I think, like, you know, basically the way that they talked him into it was by saying, like, if we release it as two movies, you know, you can release two-hour movies. You don't have to lose anything from the movie. You can just, you know, keep your entire vision intact, just spread out over a few months. And he said that he played around with it, and when he found that out point, when he created that ending for Volume 1 and that beginning for Volume 2, that's when he thought, okay, this is good. And, you know, there's different rumors and things, and, you know, I don't know. There's a lot of stuff that you hear, and you wonder what's true and what's not. But since he had always sort of intended, mainly because of the ratings board, I think, to make different versions for the Eastern and Western markets, the opening to Volume 1, from what I recall and what people have said, was originally intended to be the opening for the Asian version. And the opening to Volume 2 was going to be the opening to the American version, which kind of makes sense. Volume 1's opening is very much sort of like a samurai kind of thing. And, you know, the opening to Volume 2 is kind of like a noir sort of thing. And, you know, Asian and American, you know, genre filmmaking, but by splitting it up into two movies, he was able to use both. So I don't know, just little things like that are kind of weird. But and one of the reasons why there was the delay was because right when they were going to start making it, Uma Thurman got pregnant, so he wasn't going to recast her since she helped create the character. He decided to basically postpone production a year and then, you know, release it that way. But, okay, so, I mean, I know you're not thrilled with the movie, but, you know, after Jackie Brown and after that long wait, like, how, I mean, what was your anticipation like for this movie? Like,
I was like there. I was there opening weekend.
Okay, because, like,
The
trailer came out attached to Gangs of New York in December of 2002, and this movie came out October 10th, 2003. So, like, 10 months before the movie came out, there was the first trailer.
Yeah.
And it was like, whoa, right?
Yes, it was. I remember seeing Gangs of New York. I remember seeing the trailer and just thinking, wow. And I also remember a friend of mine. I've made many references to him, Joey, who, because of the title, Kill Bill, he started mocking it immediately, mocking the title. I was like, I like the title. What are you talking about? He's like, Kill Bill, that's a dumb title. I was like, no, it's not a dumb title. So, anyway.
He's just putting it out there in Front Street. You know, this movie, she's going to kill Bill. Yeah. That's it.
Yeah. You know, it's easy declaration.
Simple.
You
know? Simple.
Yeah. You didn't think it would be that easy, did you?
You know, for a second there, I kind of did. But... Yeah, I mean, I was right there with you, of course. You know, this is one of only two times in my life that I read the script for a movie before the movie came out. A friend of mine got a copy of it. I have no idea where he got it from. And I'm like, oh, I'm going to read, because, you know, this was like a year out. And I read the script, and I remember reading it and thinking, like, if this is as good as the script, if he's able to pull this off, this could be the best movie ever made, you know? And and then shortly after that, the trailer came out, and I was like, oh, my God, this is going to be the best movie ever made, right? And, you know, I got passes to see, like, an early screening, and I went to that screening, and I came out of it, and I'm just like, I think this is the best movie ever made for Volume One. I saw Volume One like 10 times in the theater. I loved it so much.
And we already know how I reacted. So,
but then let's cut to, you know, 6 months later, and Volume Two comes out. You know, I mean, a very different movie in a lot of ways, you know, where the first one is sort of like the kung fu movie. The second one is sort of like the Western. You know, people oftentimes, you know, talk about how the first one is Kill and the second one is Bill, you know. And, you know, I mean, I think all of that is kind of true. Now, okay, for me, like, I couldn't wait for Volume 2. I could not wait. And I had the chance to see it at, like, an advanced screening. And I like, a couple weeks before the movie came out. And a couple days before that screening, I had to go to jury duty, which I had never been to before.
Okay.
And I was like, under normal circumstances, I would totally be into jury duty. I think that this would be a fascinating thing. And I get it, but, you know, right now I just want to make sure that whatever trial I'm assigned to is over with in time for me to go see this movie, right? Mm-hmm. And I get in there and I get called in the box, right? I'm one of the people who is automatically placed in the box.
Yeah.
And they're like, this trial is going to last a couple days. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm not going to see this movie. This is the worst thing ever. And it was like a traffic thing, like a car, like a fender bender kind of deal.
Yeah.
And they're going down and they're asking everyone questions and everything like that. And then one of the things that they ask is, does everybody here have a driver's license? And I didn't. I didn't start driving until I was 28. At this point, I was 24. And me and one other person raised their hands. And then they're like, okay, you two, you can go home.
I just learned something about you that I didn't know before.
What's that?
I thought I was a late bloomer starting to drive at 18, Mike. You got me beat.
Yeah, I was terrified of it. I mean, it was like one of those things where, you know, I kind of blame my parents because my dad, being, you know, very frugal, was like, our insurance company says that if you have a driver in the house, we're going to assume that that person is driving. So if you get your license, we have to pay for your insurance, and I don't want to pay for your insurance. And I'm like, that's fine, because I don't really want to drive. And because of that, you know, I was sort of like discouraged from driving. And then it got to the point where it's like, okay, now you want me to drive, you know, like, you're teaching me this later on in life. Are you crazy? And, you know, when I was like 28 years old, basically my parents were like, we have this 11-year-old car. We're getting rid of it. It's worth absolutely nothing. If you get your license, we'll just give you the car. And I'm like,
okay, fine.
You've convinced me. Let me get my license. I still hate driving with a passion, but, you know, and everyone would always say, like, you got to get your license. You got to get your license, you know? But, man, when I didn't have my license, you know, that's what got me to see Kill Bill Volume 2. You know, I wouldn't have been able to drive to see the movie if I had there my license. Go. So I'm glad that I didn't drive.
You know, you where you live, probably the traffic is awful anyway. So
it's terrible. And Chicago has the best public transportation system in the world. So
yes, well, live in the D.C. metro area and live in a place that has one of the sparsest, you can't get anywhere in that city through the metro system.
Yeah.
It's maddening. Mm-hmm. It's like you have to go through the center of the city to get to the other side of the city. Like, it literally is just about as much time and easier at certain points just to walk to where you need to get to. So, yeah. Yeah. Okay.
So,
wow.
Okay. All right. So I was obviously, and then, you know, when I saw Volume 2, I was like, that was really good. Like, I didn't like it nearly as much as Volume 1, but now I really do see it all as one movie. And as one movie, I put it in, like, top three of all time. But what about you? Okay, so after Volume 1 came out, were you like, I'm just going to skip Volume 2?
Yep, I did.
And you did?
I hold grudges, okay? Or at least I used to. I didn't see Matrix 3 because I was mad about the ending of Matrix 2, and I didn't see Kill Bill Volume 2 because I was mad about the ending of Kill Bill Volume 1.
But didn't you? I mean,
it is that simple.
And those movies came out 1 month apart from each other. Didn't you? No. I mean, maybe I was just like too. I mean, like, going into both of those movies, I knew that there was going to be a sequel 6 months later. And that it was going to end on a cliffhanger.
Don't take me for granted, man. There are certain types of cliffhangers I'm fine with. The Lord of the Rings movies, totally fine with those cliffhangers. They worked for me because there was a whole sense of resolution and if the print of the next one got destroyed, I would still look at the one that finished and I'd say, yeah, that's still tied up in as much of a bow as you could possibly have. Fine with the Star Wars movies. You know, that sort of thing. The one aberration to my hatred for this type of thing is Back to the Future Part 2. For some reason, I give that movie a pass. I don't know why,
okay. But
I do. I know, right? I can't explain it either. I think it's because I love the spirit of Part 2 so much because I think it's just a bunch of fun. And so, like, it builds up all of this goodwill, and then it ended, and I was like, oh, okay, that's fine. But, of course, I didn't see it in the theater. I saw it much later on video, right before I went to see 3 in the theater. So maybe if Volume 2 had been released a week later, I'd have been like, yeah, okay, fine. But when I finally did get around to seeing Volume 2, I kicked myself because I thoroughly enjoyed Volume 2. Although the Superman speech is complete bunk. And I would sit down and argue this with Tarantino till the cows came home. So,
I think it's fine. I mean, I guess the whole time I'm just thinking, like, I don't really care about Superman either way, you know. But I'm like, why is he talking about Superman? Why is he such a big Superman fan? I mean, it is kind of interesting, but
no, it's not because it's raw. It's the whole thing that. I enjoy, like, you know, I enjoy doing it too, but all fans enjoy doing where you sort of like layer this read over a character that doesn't fit, but you use this sort of like you have your conclusion and then you back into it by cherry picking pieces of evidence that somebody who doesn't have a deeper knowledge of the character would be like, that sounds convincing. But like if you really break it down, it doesn't hold water what he says about Superman and the way Superman views people and stuff like that. So
I mean, that's kind of Tarantino's thing though, right? I mean, you got like the Like a Virgin conversation from Reservoir Dogs.
Yes.
You've got the very famous Top Gun conversation from some movie which I don't know what it is. You know,
was it from a movie or was it just Tarantino riffing in an interview?
It was from a movie.
I think
it was from a movie.
Was it?
Yeah, apparently. I think it's Roger Avery is like, I said that. He stole that from me, you know, something like that. But yeah, okay. But it is in a movie where Tarantino is playing himself or something at a party. Like, I think he was riffing in the movie, but yeah.
And it's cool. Like, you know, I agree with you. Like, oh, it's an innovative thing. I'm just saying, like, I would argue the point with him because I think that, you know what? What I'll say is that it completely works for Bill to say this because this is obviously Bill's point of view of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And so Bill would have this view of Superman because this is the type of person Bill is. So it's not like I'm saying it doesn't belong in the movie or I'm angry about it. It's just that I would debate it.
Yeah.
Possibly sense. Even if somebody had their Hattori Hanzo, you know, samurai sword in front of me. I'd be like, no, before you cut my head off, well, let's just talk this out here.
That's fair.
Yeah.
So you liked Volume 2. So now watching it this time with the whole thing all together, where you don't have the gap, you don't have the ending, really, you know? It's the only thing which is stopping you from watching the second part is yourself.
Yeah.
What do you think about the whole bloody affair?
I think it's absolutely brilliant. I do. I do. I desperately wish he had just gone ahead and released one film. Because he was Tarantino, right? This is his thing. Why was anybody stopping him?
He wouldn't have been able to get a 4-hour cut, though.
This is post Titanic. Why not?
Because it's still 4 hours long. I mean,
so
theaters are not. But I mean, like, theaters are not going to. I mean, you're substantially cutting down on your box office.
I'm sorry. Was There Will Be Blood 90 minutes or something? Like,
no, but it was under 3 hours. That movie's not super.
Brando got Hamlet in the theaters, and and myself and about 10 other people saw it. But
exactly.
You know, he didn't have Hamlet Volume 1 and Hamlet Volume 2.
Yeah, let's take a look at the gross of Hamlet compared to the gross of Kill Bill Volume 1, and then the gross of Kill Bill Volume 2. You know, they got people to double dip on that.
It's about art, though.
It's not show art. It's show business.
Yes, I know, but like. You know, we're talking about a guy who, I mean, you know, maybe Jackie Brown's box office reception was not what Pulp Fiction's was, but this is a guy who still made Jackie Brown.
But,
you know, like
talked about this, and he's talked about this, well, for example, Django Unchained, which we're going to be talking about in a few weeks. There's a lot that was cut out of that movie, like a good, like, hour and a half is cut out of that movie. And, you know, there was talk, like, should we split this up into two? Should we do Django Unchained Volume 1 and Django Unchained Volume 2? And he's like, no, we can't do that because that is a case where you need the resolution. You cannot end that movie on a cliffhanger. You need to finish that story in one sitting. But you can't make it 4 hours long either. Like, I think he realizes that, you know, there is, like, an experience there. You know, I mean, so much so that, like, with Hateful Eight, you know, when you had the 70mm with the grand epic whatever, where you're giving out programs and all this stuff, you can make it longer, put in an intermission. But when you're playing it at a multiplex and people are just sitting down with their popcorn to watch a movie, you can't make it that long, and you got to cut 20 minutes out of the movie. And one of the things that he said, like, with Kill Bill is, like, there are the hardcore movie buffs who can sit down and watch 4 hours of Kill Bill and not bat an eye. And I've been lucky enough to do that twice in the theater. Not with the whole Bloody Affair version, but just a double feature of Volume 1 and Volume 2. I actually...
Yeah.
Probably one of the best movie-going experiences of my life. The Music Box here in Chicago did a Quentin Tarantino double feature. Where it was Kill Bill Volume 1 and 2 followed by Grindhouse, you know?
Now see, that's kind of awesome.
It was extremely awesome. But, you know, there are people who can do that. I can do that. You can do that. You know, people can do that. But the average moviegoer, that's asking a bit too much. He says, you know, going back to his whole thing, you know, he said, you know, the average moviegoer, you need time to digest. You know, you need to watch Volume 1, go out, have a slice of pie, talk about it with your friends, and then come back next week and watch Volume 2. You know, you can't just sit down and do it all in one shot. So, and like with Django Unchained, for example, he's talked about how one day he might want to turn it into like a 4-part miniseries on HBO or something like that.
Right, because he said with people binge watching now, he's like, so long as, he was talking about the psychology of it, where it was like, I'm giving them a 4-hour movie, but they would balk at it if I gave them a 4-hour movie, but if I give them 4 1-hour episodes, they'll watch all 4 in a row.
And that's totally true. Like, I definitely have the same, you know, sort of like philosophy with that. So, like, I think he's aware that, like, it's not just about, you know, giving people everything. It's about the form that takes, you know? Mm. So, and in this case, okay. I think he realized, given the, you know, the box office and everything, the best way to do it was to release it in volume, you know, as two volumes. And, you know, of course, for years and years and years now, people have been asking for the whole bloody affair. You know, there, not a year goes by where there's not a rumor that this thing is going to get released in some form or another. And, you know, whether it's a small theatrical release followed by, you know, a DVD release or something like that, like, there are pictures from a San Diego Comic-Con in, like, 2005, where at the Miramax booth there's a mock-up of the Kill Bill Whole Bloody Affair DVD box. You know, I mean, this thing has been in development forever. There's rumors that they've animated more sequences to stick in this movie, you know, that they're sitting there, done, just ready to be released, and he just hasn't taken the time to actually cut them together. And when asked about it, he says that one of the reasons why he hasn't taken the time is because he's satisfied with the way the movie exists now as two parts. Like, it actually turned out well in that regard, and because of that, he doesn't feel the need to do it. You know, not that it wouldn't be preferable to have this other version, but is it worth the effort? I don't know.
I'd rather he keeps the eye on the prize and keeps Star Trek moving along.
Yeah, I think that's yeah. Cool. And speaking of Star Trek, this is the one.
Yes.
This is the one. Now, in the
right.
Japanese version, the movie starts off with a dedication to, I forget the guy's name, but the director of Battle Royale, who had just passed away. At the time, he's acknowledged Battle Royale as a huge influence on Kill Bill, maybe the biggest influence on Kill Bill, and because of that, he dedicated the movie to him. But in America, where nobody knows who this guy is, he started off the movie the way that it is in the script, and this was the first thing that I noticed in the script, because it was the first thing in there, and it blew my mind. You know, it starts off with a quote, "Revenge is a dish that is best served cold," and it's credited as an old Klingon proverb. So,
yeah,
that means that Kill Bill takes place in the Star Trek universe. I mean, and well, I guess
why not?
just one more thing, just to, as it kind of makes sense. We haven't talked about this, but Tarantino movies, shared universes, right? He's explained this before. There's the movie universe and the movie universe. And the movie universe is like a regular universe with like Pulp Fiction, Reservoir Dogs, you know, these types of things. And, you know, all these characters exist in this universe. So, you know, Vincent Vega could cross paths with Mr. Pink or whatever. It could happen, right?
Yeah.
And then there's the movie universe, which is movies like Kill Bill and From Dusk Till Dawn and Django Unchained, or maybe not Django Unchained, but Inglourious Basterds for sure, right?
Yeah.
And those are the movies that the people in the movie universe watch when they go to see movies. And the movie universe is one universe, and those characters can interact. The movie universe is another universe. Those characters can interact, but the two universes cannot interact with each other, with the exception of one character, the wolf from Pulp Fiction, who is a movie universe character living in the movie universe. He has the ability to cross over from one universe to the other. So, there you go.
Seriously, I love the way his brain works. I really, really adore it. It's so much fun.
Oh, yeah.
Just to follow his logic chains. It's so much fun.
So, I don't know which universe Star Trek would exist in. Maybe the Prime universe is the movie universe and the JJ verse is the movie universe. Who knows? I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah.
That sounds about right. Yeah.
Anyway, we could talk about Kill Bill forever, but we do need to mention one more thing, because I promised Brandon.
Okay.
He's like,
oh.
He's like, on IMDb, there's a credit for, you know, an in-development movie called Kill Bill Volume 3. You know, you got to talk about that. What is that? And it does relate to Star Trek in a kind of maybe perhaps unfortunate way. In the press and everything like that, you know, when Volume 2 came out, you know, people would say, is there going to be a Volume 3? And Tarantino would say, like, oh, you know, I have this idea that maybe 10 years down the road, you know, there is that scene at the beginning of the movie where she kills Vernita Green in front of her daughter, right?
Mm-hmm.
I could see, you know, that character, that little girl growing up and seeking revenge on the bride, and she'd be, you know, completely justified in that because the bride killed her mom, you know? So,
right.
Kill Bill Volume 3, you'd have the bride as essentially the bad guy, the Bill character. And
yeah, she'd be Bill.
So I always thought it would be called Kill B, right? That's what I would
say. That would work.
Yeah, that's what I would call it. But whatever. Yeah. And then, you know, you would also have her daughter being, you know, that same age and, you know, all this stuff and, you know.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, it's one of those things where he's like, I'd like to do that, but not for like a decade because the bride deserves her peace. Like he says things like this, whatever.
Of course he does.
Yeah. And, you know, it's one of those things just like the Vega Brothers movie where, you know, he talks about it and says maybe one day and then it never happens. And I think the likelihood of it happening is very, very small now. And, you know, I was just listening to an interview with Paul Thomas Anderson recently where, you know, they were asking him if there were ever any movies which he was trying to make that which never got made. And he said that there weren't. And, you know, they were saying like, oh, because, you know, Tarantino, he talks about it all the time. And the two of them are friends. And, you know, Paul Thomas Anderson was like, well, Tarantino has this problem where, you know, he makes a movie and he gets excited about that movie and he starts thinking about other possibilities and he starts talking about all of these ideas that he has, but they're nothing more than ideas. They're things which would never really be movies. But, you know, when you're coming off of making Kill Bill, you're like, maybe one day I'll do another Kill Bill. And yeah, he's not going to do that. He just, you know, runs off his mouth more than he should. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And, you know, yeah. You could say like, okay, is that what's happening with Star Trek right now? Right. And it could be, but here's the thing. He's not talking about Star Trek right now. You know, he's not in the press saying like, I want to do, you know, I mean, he did like 2 years ago, just as sort of like a thing, but this is like a thing which is happening, which hasn't been announced. Right. I mean, Paramount's right. Not like we are going into production on this thing. It's just something which is being done and nobody is talking about it. And that to me makes me think like it is more of a reality than Kill Bill Volume 3 because it's not something that people are talking about. It's something that people are doing, you know?
Right. It's not somebody saying, oh, I have this great idea. It's somebody with a writer's room who hired a screenwriter to come up with a draft for an idea that he had, you know, like that is a markedly different thing because yeah, you know, to come out of whatever film he's working on and be like, oh yeah, I got a great idea. If I ever did a sequel for this.
Right. He's talked about that with Inglourious Bastards. I mean, he's talked about this on numerous occasions with numerous movies. You know, Hateful Eight was originally supposed to be a sequel to Django Unchained, you know,
what he should do is he should sell everything to Disney and then they can make a connected universe and all of these ideas that he had can
there
come
you go
to fruition.
There you go. Yeah. I mean, the one thing that he has done, like with Django, you know, he has done a sequel idea that he had as a comic book where he crosses over with Zorro.
Of course. Of course he crossed over with Zorro.
Yeah, why wouldn't you? But
and now I have to look this up. So
it's drawn by Matt Wagner and co-written by Wagner and Tarantino.
Nice.
I mean, come on. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
That sounds like the best thing ever. Anyway, it's been fun talking about Kill Bill today, but that's not all we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Warp 5.
You don't want to give up what makes you human or makes you moral or good just to save the structure and the trappings and even your own lives and that kind of thing. So, and that is the real dilemma. And ultimately, Archer has to answer that for himself, whether he really is giving up his humanity. And
Earl Grey.
Do you even pick up a piece of trash?
Yes. You know, and so just that story of you accomplished this, you know, and that your ancestor that did this. And so don't throw it away and just give it to her, because those are your works and your successes and your contributions.
To the journey!
I do feel the need to supply the missing melody, since we're not actually listening to it. We're just watching it with no sound. Bring us home, Kay. Bring us home. Back to the Alpha Talk. Back in the Alpha Quadrant.
Yeah, we got it.
The Edge, a Star Trek Discovery podcast.
See, I would love that. I would love to have a scene where Voke and Tyler meet. Like, and I would be just fine with that. I don't need this to be the thing. And honestly, like, when I watched Choose Your Pain the first time, I watched the episode. I didn't think for a second he would have been Voke. I didn't think of that at all.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
Check out these shows and join the conversation about your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button in Apple Podcasts on your iPhone, iPad, or Apple TV, or the desktop iTunes app to get the latest episodes as soon as they're published, and please leave us a star rating and a written review. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Google Play Music, Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and in most third-party apps, and you can stream and download the MP3 files from our website and grab the RSS link as well. We'd love to hear your thoughts on today's episode, and there are many ways for you to do that. The best place is to join in the larger conversation on the Babel Conference. That's our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, and it should come right up. If you'd like to send us an email, you can use the form on our website at trek.fm/contact. Just choose to send to a show and select Stage 9. That'll come right to us. You can also find the network on Twitter at TrekFM and on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me as Kessel Junkie on your social network of choice. You can also find me over on the Nerd Party, co-hosting Aggressive Negotiations with Matthew Rushing. You can find me co-hosting Words with Nerds with my pal Craig. And you can find me again on the Nerd Party, co-hosting Great Shot Kid with you.
Yeah, you can find me over there in the Nerd Party doing Great Shot Kid, and you can also find me right here on Trek FM doing The Edge, and you can find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K. We'd like to thank our associate producers today, Jeff Sutter, Chris Steftenagel, and Norman C. Lau. Thank you very much, guys. If you'd like to be like Jeff, Chris, and Norm and help us out, head on over to patreon.com/trekfm and become a patron of the network. If you go to patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you can get all of the details, including perks like early access to episodes, exclusive content, producer credits, and more, available through our special patrons website, Patron Zone. It requires a great deal of money to produce, host, and distribute these shows each month, and we really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. All right. Well, that was a long episode, but, you know, it's a long movie.
You can listen to this in two parts.
You can.
Mike's going to go back in, and he's going to record a little stinger bump sort of thing where, I don't know, What have you kept secret from me?
He's talking about the movie universe or something like that.
Yeah,
right?
Something like that. Yeah.
No, I'm not going to do any of that. Sorry, guys. but next week, we are going to be talking about the next film by Quentin Tarantino. A bit of an odd one for a number of reasons, but that movie is his half of Grindhouse, Death Proof.